My guest is Laszlo Andor. Laszlo Andor is the Secretary General of the Foundation for European Progressive Studies and a former European Commissioner from Hungary. Welcome to the podcast, Laszlo.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
Right, we're going to start obviously by talking about Viktor Orban. Now, to many people outside Hungary, they might just think that Viktor Orban has been a leader, a prominent person on the Hungarian political scene relatively recently, but as you know better than anybody, he has been, just to remind our listeners, Prime Minister of your country since 2010, and before that from 1998 to 2002, according to my research, and head of his party, Fidesz, since 1993, with a pause between 2000 and 2003. So, how do you assess the political success of Orbán from his very beginnings, almost 30 years ago now?
I think we have to acknowledge that this is a unique political career. It's even rooted in the change of regime back in 1989 when he made his first public intervention after organizing a youth organization, which then was turned into a party. But indeed, he appeared as a radical young liberal political leader. And he made his march towards the center right, became the unifier of the center-right in Hungary in the late 1990s, and then ended up what a lot of political scientists call just an outright far-right leader, because after 2010, he unilaterally changed the political system because he had gained a constitutional majority in the 2010 parliamentary elections. Without any consultation, they imposed a new basic law, a new electoral law, and many new laws, which, according to many, created an autocratic system where the leader can be changed, perhaps, but a lot of people still doubt this. And there have been many, many talks among politicians, but also political experts, constitutional experts, whether this is still a democracy or not. As you know, the European Parliament launched a procedure based on two reports because of the lack of basic norms and standards of the rule of law and democracy in Hungary.
Well, we all know now that these disputes between Orban and his fellow colleagues in the European Union are kind of a fact of life now and almost daily occurrences. But what's the point when you think he became overtly and systematically, quote unquote, anti-European and didn't go along with the kind of majority view of the European project? And what spurred it? What instigated that?
Again, I think this goes back to longer than many people observe, because in the mid-1990s, as a young MP, he was already chairing the European Affairs Committee of the Hungarian Parliament. Subsequently, he became Prime Minister when all the negotiations took place. My belief is that he already at that time became semi-Eurosceptic. And when Hungary had a referendum about joining the European Union, he actually said publicly that there are advantages, but also disadvantages of EU membership, and there are a little bit more advantages than disadvantages. So he was already preparing for himself a platform where, from which he can oppose a variety of EU policies. I think he and many around him became somehow convinced that the European Union, the single market itself, is somehow orchestrated against us, against weaker countries. For example, joining a single currency became a no-go for him,
Right.
and various other aspects which are not absolutely mandatory in the European Union are just completely sidelined. He packages this anti-Europeanness in an ideology of a Europe of nations. So
Right.
basically, says that he is a defender of a Europe of nations, and he organized this new club, the Patriots, around this Eurosceptic philosophy.
Well, we'll come back to that, the Patriots group, in a second, Laszlo. In the meantime, I'm not sure it's a strategy, but his tactics seem to be very successful. Either he's successful, despite often being in a minority of one, in blocking initiatives, or if he doesn't block, he manages to get a concession out of his fellow leaders or from the European Commission as a way to remove his blocking of a policy initiative. So it's effective, no? And the EU26, as you say, seem powerless to fight that.
Yes, I think this is a very skillful, at the same time unscrupulous approach to European negotiations and decision making. I would agree that this is primarily a transactional relationship to organize blocking minorities, to create political capital out of a negative attitude to new initiatives,
right.
And then you can trade it in for something if necessary. There have been many examples of this. For example, I think a lot of people observed last December when Hungary somehow facilitated the decision at the end about the accession talks with Ukraine. But simultaneously what happened, a small portion of the funds that had been withheld by the European Commission were suddenly released. And there is obviously a lot of suspicion that this was somehow negotiated and managed.
Do you think he's been successful in building allies around the European Council table amongst his fellow leaders? Obviously, there's been a change of government in Poland in the last few months. Donald Tusk is back in that job of prime minister, much more pro-European. But is he quietly trying to find allies, or is he happy just to work on his own when push comes to shove?
Yes, this is a very interesting question. I think people sit in the room and you say that the friends of Orbán should stand up, everybody would remain seated. At the same time, if the question is whether he can collaborate with Macron on questions on nuclear energy or agriculture, the answer is yes. Whether he can talk with his Austrian opposite number on migration issues, immigration, Schengen, the answer is yes, although on Schengen they would differ, because on Schengen the Hungarian government sides with Romania, and probably that's an issue on which he could speak with the Romanian prime minister, even if there is a big gulf of opinions between them, and they would be separated on many other issues otherwise. So I think case by case, there are quite a few issues where there are talking relationships, occasionally cooperation, but overall I think it remains true that Hungary is pretty much marginalized, and the reactions to his so-called peace tour also reveal this marginalization, and the way he becomes even more isolated when he's supposed to run a council presidency of Hungary. This is really, really ironic.
Well, let's delve deeper then, Aszlo, into the Hungarian presidency. Just to remind everybody, in case they need reminding, Hungary holds the rotating presidency of the EU since the 1st of July. Just a couple of weeks old now, and as you just mentioned briefly, maybe you could explain for some of our listeners what it entails. He's been on this so-called quote-unquote peace tour. First of all, maybe you explain what this peace tour entailed, Laszlo, and secondly, were you surprised that he actually undertook it in the first place?
I think the peace tour was really spectacular, probably well thought through by Orbán himself and a couple of people around him, but a lot of details had to be kept in secret because this was indeed an absolutely unusual sequence of visits, starting in Kiev, visiting President Zelensky, and then following up to Moscow, and then to Beijing, but in the meantime also hitting the meeting of the Turkic countries, and then finishing in Washington at the NATO summit, and then visiting Donald Trump in Florida. And all allegedly under the objective of making peace in Ukraine. And I think everybody knows that on the question of Ukraine, the Hungarian government has been the least solidaristic. Of course, we delivered the minimum. We received refugees. We provided financial support. So I think what we can call an absolute minimum was delivered. But from day one, it was a very negative opinion about delivering weapons. And I should not forget mentioning that this was probably also linked to the fact that a few days before the Russian aggression, Orbán actually visited Moscow, right? So he was one of the last heads of state or government which talked with President Putin before he invaded Ukraine in 2022, February. So whether anybody gives credit to this tour, probably not. I think this is a kind of ex post justification of turning the election campaign of Fidesz, his party, to building it around the questions of war and peace. Because we had, like everybody in Europe, a spring election campaign, partly European, but in Hungary it was also municipal. And in the last phase, it was all about war and peace, what concerns Orbán. That the big danger is war. If you vote for the opposition, you will get war, and our sons and daughters will be taken to Ukraine to fight. And at the same time, if you vote Orbán, you have stability, you have peace, and your life is saved. So that was basically the message in a nutshell. And I think he exposed, tried to justify, also by triggering these reactions from the Western leaders. That the West is for war, and the sole leader in Europe who has the decency to mention peace, that's Viktor Orban himself. Maybe it was also helping to form at the same time his Eurosceptic alliance, in which he appeared as a spiritus rector. He is not going to be the former leader, but he probably also demonstrated to Meloni, to the Austrian Freedom Party, to other would-be members, Marine Le Pen, that he is actually someone with the standing to be able to visit all these people. As I highlighted, the tour started in Kiev, which is very important because he's been the only leader in the European Union who had not yet visited Ukraine since the start of the war. There are several prime ministers who actually went twice to visit President Zelensky to express solidarity, to deliver support. And for him, it took the start of the Hungarian presidency to make this very first visit.
Right. I do promise we'll come on to his new group in the European Parliament in a second. Let's finish off on the Hungarian presidency, Laszlo.
Yes.
Okay, you're suggesting therefore that this so-called peace mission basically backfired, but for the rest of the kind of what I would call the meat and potatoes of any kind of presidency program, is there any scope for Hungary and obviously Viktor Orbán himself to push a more pro-Hungarian priorities during this 6 month period or not?
I think after this bad start, a lot of people will not pay attention to the other elements of the program, and it will all be downplayed and sidelined. But there are a couple of issues on the list which, in principle, could be turned into a constructive discussion. The current Hungarian government is very much in favor of the integration of the Western Balkans, for example, and a lot of people, obviously, also in Brussels, talk about the accession of the Western Balkan countries. And indeed, it would be important in case the discussion could be constructive and forward-looking. They also put, regarding economic policy, the question of competitiveness into the center stage. We are all waiting for the report of Mario Draghi to be published on this matter. So again, it could be something constructive, unless it becomes, from the presidency side, just an opportunity to propagate various measures like the introduction of the flat tax, which they had done in order to keep the foreign investment running in Hungary in the previous years. I should also mention the question of demography. This is returning to the agenda. And a lot of people would say demography is not really an EU issue. I think in a constructive approach, one could have a constructive discussion. I'm not sure what is still being prepared under this question because the policies regarding demography have not been very successful by the Orbán government. So they haven't really have much to propagate here.
Okay, well, let's then finally move on to the European Parliament after the elections of last month. We all know now that Orbán has taken quite an audacious move, some would say, in creating a brand new far-right group called Patriots of Europe, to which you alluded just now. And as he managed to take some members from Giorgia Meloni's European Conservative and Reformist group. What importance do you attach to this move that he's made, Orbán? And is this new group, Patriots for Europe, going to be an important voice in the new parliament?
Well, I would agree with those who say that this has been a rebranding exercise of the Identitarian and Democracy group, which was previously associated with Le Pen, Marine Le Pen. And now, surprisingly, it's chaired by Bardella, the young non-prime minister of France. So it might be just as significant or insignificant as the previous identitarian group. I think what is interesting that since they turned a more extreme far-right group more powerful, I think the intended or unintended consequence is that they are weakening the ECR. They are weakening the group of Meloni. So altogether, these 2.5 of the broad far right in Europe are probably a little bit more confused, fragmented than some people would have thought beforehand.
Right. Okay. So in other words, as they said that just after elections, the center has held EPP, the Social Democratic Group, SND, and Liberals are still cohesive, and they're going to be the most influential bloc in the next parliament. Is that what you're saying?
I would indeed say that centre-left, centre-right and the Liberals together continue to form a governing bloc. At the same time, I would caution against any kind of complacency, because the centre has held just about. And the centre has been eroding for some time. This time the EPP has become a little bit stronger than before, but the Liberals have weakened. And the SND group is more or less stable. But for a more stable, let's say, centrist, progressive, constructive coalition government of the European Union, this group would need to have a stronger representation. And if you ask me, obviously others might not agree, but we would need a significantly stronger center-left.
Right. I'd ask you a quick question, which may seem rather strange, about the victory of Keir Starmer in the United Kingdom recently, just 10 days, 12 days ago now. It's wearing your hat as Secretary General of the Foundation for European Progressive Studies. The left, the centre-left in Europe is not doing particularly well. We all know that the UK has left the European Union. That's not a scoop. I presume you're very happy about this result of the British Labour Party, but do you think that beyond that, and the negotiations which are now starting to take place between them, a closer relationship between the EU and the United Kingdom, do you think that the Labour Party from the UK can in some way, indirectly at least, have some influence in Europe going forward?
I think this has already started, and I would indeed say that this is an historic change. I think most of us remember 1997 when Tony Blair became prime minister. And of course, there are many differences as well, but that also took place after a long period of conservative government in the UK, when the relationship between the European Union became progressively problematic. This issue was kind of internally very divisive for the Tory party. We have seen the same in the last 5-6 years, with the difference that the pro-European wing of the Tory party was basically completely destroyed. And I think the self-destruction of the Conservative Party is really spectacular. I think Keir Starmer knows that the country needs stability and economic growth. And if they can deliver this, they can build a lot on these foundations. And there have been already many gestures that the new government would like to develop more constructive relations with the European Union. Important meetings have taken place, including in the European Championship final, when Starmer was also meeting Olaf Scholz and Pedro Sanchez. Why not? I mean, it's an excellent opportunity. And just like this together, indeed, can coordinate a lot and ensure that the frictions would be matters of the past, and then some new chapter can be opened.
Right. I'd like to finish off, Laszlo, by bringing the conversation full circle to more or less where we started. In other words, how the European Union deals with Hungary and the tactics and the behavior of Viktor Orban, the prime minister. There was talk, obviously, in the one point, obviously, which went nowhere, about abolishing, in effect, the Hungarian presidency of the EU. That didn't work out, obviously. There was also more serious talk, potentially, of withholding voting rights of Hungary. I'm not sure where we stand on that. How do you think the European Union is doing in dealing with Orban? Obviously, he's been around for a long time. He's not going anywhere soon. His tactics and his antics, some would say, are getting more and more egregious. So is the problem is going to be there and growing in the future? What can the EU do in response?
Well, this is a dilemma we have been facing for 10 years or longer. I think with hindsight, a lot of people would say that the opportunity was missed around 2013-14 to suspend the voting rights of the Hungarian government before a similar government took over in Poland. And that Polish government fulfilled two cycles. They are out. Poland is basically back to normal. And Hungary is still stuck. I think it's very difficult to identify a kind of silver bullet which would solve all problems. Some people saw this conditionality mechanism of the EU funds, which would eventually force the government to make kind of deep changes. Instead, they have been making, let's say, cosmetic changes or just a little bit more in order to restore a compliant absorption of the EU funds. At the same time, I think the withholding the EU funds has made an impact because there was, you know, lack of investment, lack of job creation in the last few years. And it showed in the recent election results. So We did see in the spring period the rise, a very sudden rise of a new political party, which now appears as, let's call it, a main challenger of Orbán. At the same time, if something suddenly comes, it can also suddenly go. So, you know, any kind of serious political party needs foundations, needs membership, needs a tradition, needs to form a government alternative. So that's still to be seen how it works out in the next few years. But I think what the European, you know, community of nations in various formats, in which, you know, we should also include the British, although not an EU member now. So what should not happen is a kind of just brushing this under the carpet.
Right.
And saying, okay, if the Hungarian question is too complex, we should do nothing. It's for the Hungarians to solve. I think there is a kind of triple lock in the political system, which doesn't really allow a fundamental change. There is so much tinkering with the electoral law, even the competencies of what we call a fiscal council would mean that even if Fidesz would lose an absolute majority, if a new parliament cannot approve the budget and the fiscal council expresses a negative opinion, then the head of state can dissolve the parliament. So yeah, there are a lot of tricky solutions installed in this system, which would make it very, very difficult to make a substantial transfer of power to a different force. So all these would need to be, I think, constantly pointed out, criticized, and somehow a cooperation of the EU as a community, but also the more constructive forces inside the country could perhaps result in a change, hopefully sooner rather than later.
Okay, well, we have to leave it there. Laszlo Andor, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.